I won't apologize for taking up space in the world. I'm living large and I'm not gonna stop. My body sings and dances and it's a tiger in the bedroom. And that's just some of why my fat body rocks.
Herzlich willkommen zum Larger Living Podcast, dein Podcast zum original intuitiven Essen nach Rash und Triboli, Health at Every Size, Body Image, Feminismus und einer Prise Ethnologie. Ich bin Dot und ich bin deine Wegweiserin raus aus dem Diätendschungel hin zu mehr Selbstakzeptanz, mehr Selbstvertrauen, gesunder Selbstfürsorge und Frieden mit dem Essen und deinem Körper. Lehn dich zurück, mach's dir gemütlich, schnapp dir ein Heißgetränk deiner Wahl. Wir legen los. Hello, dear listeners. Yes, don't adjust the settings on your phone or PC or radio device. This is my real voice. Yeah, when I speak English, I sound like that. Some people are very astonished when they hear me talk in the foreign tongue, but this is actually how I sound like, and I do have an accent. Yes, I know, I'm aware of it. Sometimes it shows through. Sometimes I might miss a TH or two, but I assure you that I can understand everything that you're saying, and I hope that you can understand my English, even though I do have this lovely little cutesy German accent going on. This episode is a very special one to me, and it's You will rarely hear such a thing coming out of my mouth, because I do not consider myself being woo-woo in any kind of way, or esoteric, or spiritual, or something like that. I always considered myself to be an atheist. Lately, the last past years, I've moved more from atheism to agnosticism, or call myself more of an agnostic, because I am more likely to believe in such a thing as cosmic fate. Yeah, especially for this episode, this is true, because I'm talking to the woman responsible for me sitting here today and talking to you. I'm talking to the woman who predominantly helped me cure my binge eating disorder. And I don't want to go too much into details right now, and I don't want to, you know, tell you my binge life story. That's some stuff for another episode with a big fat trigger warning on top of it. But for now, I can reveal who I'm talking to, and at the same time, I have to apologize a little bit to her because I did not do her justice. This was my first podcast interview, and I was nervous as fuck, and I was just nervous about the whole, you know, thing not recording, and I interrupted her a few times, and so I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, and I can now reveal who I was talking to. Isabel Fox and Duke. Yeah, you hear right. If you don't know who Isabel is, then please check her out on isabelfoxanduke.com. So it's Isabel Foxen, like the fox, and E-N, and Duke, like Daisy Duke, .com. Well, first of all, she is also, like, she's taking no shit, and she knows her shit. She's really, she tells it like it is, and that inspired me to do the same. Even though I know that I might not be that mainstream friendly when I'm cursing, even in Germany, I think even more so in Germany, to be fair. So Isabel is a binge eating disorder specialist. And she was the first one to really blow my mind when she told me and millions of other women, I'm sure, in countless interviews that she has done, that you can only cure binge eating disorder when you address the underlying issues that are going on, and when you ask yourself the radical question, what else would be going on than if you were not eating right now? What else? What else is going on? So this catapulted me into a spiral of healing. And she, of course, then introduced me and millions of others to intuitive eating and then sequentially to health at every size. And later on, through her newsletter, to Virgie Tovar, who then introduced me to fat acceptance and the radical question, what if it were okay to be fat? So Isabel is really where everything started for me in my journey. So it just feels like really like a wink of fate winking at me with her being my first podcast guest. So I want to do her justice this time and in editing, in post. And I want to introduce her to all of you in a proper way. So Isabel has been featured on The Huffington Post, Elle, Ricky, XO Jane, Refinery29, Red Book, and Bustle, among many, many more. So Isabel has this amazing newsletter or guide, weekly-ish, that is called How to Not Eat Cake, really fast, standing up while no one is watching. Great title, even better little nuggets of truth in there. I love it and I highly recommend it. Then she has a video series going on, also for free, that is called Stop Fighting Food. StopFightingFood.com to be exact. And the one thing that is so amazing and that I really want to promote here is her masterclass. Her masterclass is, like she really said, like her magnum opus. But she put so much work into this and you get so much value now for such a little price. I remember it used to be 4 figures, and now she reduced it to either one payment of $597 or 3 payments of $250. And she's not the only one to teach. It's 6 modules, and she has guests like Sama Inanen, Virgie Tovar, Deb Bogard, like really, really experts in the field. And yeah, it's really affordable now. I feel a little bit guilty that I haven't taken the class, and she's right when she says that I should take it. But she offers something else that I also want to drop here. And that is, she now offers professional training and mentoring. That's right. She trains the new generation of coaches, healthcare providers, professionals, and she really wants to bring the weight neutral approach to the world and help others make an impact. And I quote her, "The world needs more leaders, more activists, and more body positive wellness professionals with the resources and support necessary to make an impact." Because quite frankly, when you're new to this field like I am, you don't quite know what to charge. That's the first thing. And you don't quite know how to market yourself. And I was a little bit, I don't know, overbearing at the end of the interview, as you will hear very soon, because I really spoke from the heart. This is really what's going on for most of us anti-diet coaches, for most of us anti-diet professionals also, or anti-diet nutritionists, even more, that we all feel that we are like Don Quixote up against this giant windmill of diet culture and the diet industry, that has like the best marketing claims. It's just like, yeah, get rid of your problem fast by using our product, and to sell the anti-diet message is much harder than it sounds like and than it looks like, because you have so much, yeah, to undo with your clients. You have to convince them to give up a dream that they, to this day, hold on to. The dream of thinness, which then, of course, also entails, you know, being not just thin, but also desirable. Being not just thin, but also, you know, productive. That was my cat. Being not just thin, but being valued, deemed a valuable member of society, basically. So when you're anti-diet, you are anti that dream to many, many people. So I'm super curious about that program myself. I really recommend it to you if you're willing to take your business to the next level. Isabel really knows her shit, and I do trust her to deliver excellent content. So I think I've done her justice now. I also want to thank her one last time before I give you the whole interview, because Isabel has been nothing but nice in this, like absolutely, like really patient with me, really patient with my anxiety and everything. Thank you, Isabel. Yeah, so please check her out and now enjoy our interview.
Hi, Isabel. I'm thrilled that you are my first podcast guest, actually.
I love it.
Yeah. And like we talked about it before, I really feel that today is a faithful day for me because you are actually the reason that I'm sitting here today and that I'm doing this work. Mm. Like, you are the reason why I am no longer on a diet.
Yeah, hell yeah. That's really where the juice is.
Yep. And you are the reason why I finally feel comfortable within my own skin.
Mm. Hallelujah. I love that, man. Jeez. That is the most, I feel like if we're not, that's the most important, one of the most important things in life is being able to live in your own skin. Right. So anything that helps people do that is, you know, it's such a gift. So it's an honor to have helped.
Yeah, it's like, to me, it really feels like my whole cycle is beginning and ending, like the, you know, the snake that bites its own tail, the Ouroboros. I really feel like today is right now is a Ouroboros moment, kind of beginning and end at the same time, end of me being just a lay person, just a, you know, armchair fat activist, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're more than that at this point. I know. Taking names in Germany. I'm so excited for all the movement that's going to be happening in Germany because of you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so, so much. And like, it's thanks to you. Like you really helped me at a very dark time in my life, and you helped me work through this, and you helped me, like you challenged me in a way where I asked myself, yeah, what else is going on besides me eating right now?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like if I weren't eating right now, what else would I be feeling?
Hmm. Hmm.
What else would be going on? Mm-hmm. And to me at that time, that was so radical. Right?
Yeah. The concept of how we eat is related to how we feel and what our beliefs are and how we think about ourselves, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that was the start. And you even did more. Like I, of course, I subscribed to your newsletter, as should everyone who can read English from my followers. Mm-hmm. I will obviously translate. I didn't say that before, but I just wanted to make sure to say that now. My service to my followers and my listeners will be to take some nuggets of truth from this podcast interview, to clip them in, to translate them into German, and to offer some context around it in German, because there is not so much going on in German at the moment. So I will publish this interview in English and then kind of do my own little translation work and publish that a week after.
Great. I love it. All right, cool. Let's do it.
Yeah. So please, I mean, I obviously know you. And I found you back then when I was Googling or like Googling on YouTube or YouTubing, I'm not sure, YouTube searching, content about binge eating. Mm-hmm. And you, I know that you have a little different definition of binge eating and emotional eating. And to me, your view made so much more sense than what I was hearing at the time. So would you care to elaborate on that?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because I think we live in a culture where the words binge eating and the words emotional eating are kind of used, they're often used like interchangeably, first of all, right? Like people confuse them and jumble them up, right? People, you know, I think a lot of people think of binge eating as just a lot of emotional eating, right? So, you know, most people think of emotional eating as, and I would agree with this definition, right? I kind of give the definition of emotional eating being, you know, either eating to soothe or comfort or distract from, you know, over difficult or overwhelming feelings. And most people think of binge eating as just like an extra amount of emotional eating. Sometimes I think in our culture, people think of binge eating as, you know, people give different definitions of binge eating, like, oh, it's eating that feels quote unquote out of control, which is an interesting use of words that I want to comment on in a second. But for the most part, people in our culture talk about binge eating like it's an addiction, like it's a coping mechanism for feelings. That has nothing to do whatsoever with dieting. And the reality of the situation is that I don't know a single, I don't know a single person who struggles with binge eating who is not also dieting. I would argue like if you are, I mean, well, we could get into the semantics here, but, you know, according to my definition, right, like if you are binge eating by definition, which is not the same thing in my opinion as just eating a lot of food, right? Like binge eating, you are reacting to deprivation of some kind, right? When you stop dieting, the binge eating will cease by this definition. So that is sort of my definition of binge eating, is a reaction to deprivation. And deprivation can look a lot of different ways. Dieting comes in a lot of different forms. So binge eating is, oh my gosh, I've been holding myself from eating the bread for so long. I can't hang on 1 second longer. I'm going to dive into the bread, right? I'm going to dive into the bread basket. I'm going to eat all the bread. And then I'm going to hate myself for having eaten the bread. And I'm going to say, well, I already screwed up. So, you know, might as well just eat everything else that's in my cabinets. And then tomorrow, I promise I'll never eat bread again. Right. Yeah. So there's this relationship between binge eating and control. I mean, even the way, and I just said, people describe binge eating as feeling out of control. That means by definition that there was an attempt to control in the first place. Right.
Very true. And,
right. You cannot feel out of control unless you were trying to be in control to begin with. Right. You cannot fall off of a wagon with food unless you are on a wagon with food, unless you are attempting to abide by a specific set of rules, unless you are attempting to self-control around food in some way. And because we live in a culture, right, we live in a dominant culture that basically thinks that, well, of course I'm trying to control myself around food. Isn't everyone trying to control? Right? Control is the dominant, you know, idea of food, right? I think there's this idea that everyone's trying to control their food, right? That control is the way we must all control our food. But this is a relatively new idea in history, right? Like we are human animals. We are basically monkeys. It wasn't until semi-recently that we decided food was something that needed to be controlled, right? Like prior to the 20th century, and again, the history is complex and goes well before, diet culture history goes well before the 20th century, but for the most part, en masse, with like mass movements of people really dieting, you don't see a ton of trying to control around food prior to the 20th century. Prior to the 20th century, you see actually more of the opposite, right? Like there's food insecurity. You want to eat as much as you can. You want to get food, right? Potentially, depending again on class situations. But you definitely, there's not this attitude of I need to control myself around food. That's a relatively new historical development, especially when you're talking about mass scale.
Yeah.
Right. So, and similarly, right, this is when you also really start to hear terms like binge eating and terms like emotional eating goes hand in hand with this new cultural development of trying to control food. Right. So, this all long story short, right. When we talk about emotional eating, right? Well, it's just eating to, you know, I'm sad, I'm lonely, I want a cupcake, I want to just like kind of soothe myself.
Yeah.
In my opinion, that's a very different phenomenon than, oh my gosh, I haven't had bread in 4 months. I can't hold back 1 second longer, and then diving into the bread basket. Or, you know, oh my gosh, I already blew my diet. So I might as well eat everything that isn't nailed down. And then tomorrow I will, you know, get back up on day one, start again.
Right? I stop those, back on Monday.
Right. Start back up on Monday. Right.
Yeah.
So there's a difference between I'm sad, I'm lonely, I'm anxious, I want a cupcake on the one hand, and oh my gosh, I already screwed up today. I might as well eat everything that isn't nailed down and start day one again tomorrow. Right. These are two different things.
Oh yeah.
And so binge eating really, in my opinion, is this particular type of eating that we're talking about, right? It's eating in reaction to dieting in some way, right? It's, you know, I put myself on, you know, a super strict caloric diet. And then by the end of the day, I just can't stop thinking about food. I'm so hungry. And I just end up like diving into the kitchen, just uncontrollably. I go on autopilot basically.
Yeah.
And just, you know, stuffing myself because I just can't hold back 1 second longer. Right. And
oh yeah,
I think a lot of people do describe binge eating that way. Like binge eating feels like kind of like an alien taking over your brain. Like you're not even, you know, there's this concept of no control, right? Like,
oh,
something
totally
else is coming from within me and just taking over my body. Aliens are taking over my body and like putting food in my mouth. That's kind of how it feels, right? And it doesn't matter how full I am or what. It's like, I cannot, my conscious brain no longer matters.
It's no longer
running the show.
It's like with, you know, the old movie Being John Malkovich.
Yes.
Like his consciousness is like kind of, sorry, do the sound effects too. And someone else is crawling up inside and takes kind of over the reign. And you know, the binge personality kind of sees it with the binge personality's eyes and is like doing all the things, but you kind of are there, but you are the Malkovich puppet to your binge mind in a way.
Yeah. I mean, and I would call it, it's not, I don't even like the term the binge mind because it's actually the healthy animal instinct mind.
So true.
That wants to save you from yourself. Right. I mean, the reality is, so another way of thinking about this is like, right, if I try to starve myself, there are deep, deep, deep internal biological instincts that will take over and make sure that I don't starve myself, right?
Yes.
So it's actually very similar to breathing, right? So we think of breathing. Breathing is something that I, in theory, can control temporarily, right? Like, right? I can make my breath go in and out at the pace that I want. I can take in the amount of air that I want. I have some level of control over my breath for a short period of time.
True.
At some point, if I am not getting the oxygen that my body actually needs, my biological instincts, my animal instincts, right, will take over and my conscious mind will go completely offline and I will start gasping for air.
Yeah. Right?
And I will not have that ability that I had short term to consciously control my breath will go away. Right. And so this is very similar to food. It's like in the short term, we have the ability to make conscious choices about food, right? In the short term, I can say, you know what? I have a meeting right now. I have to wait. I'm going to wait until after my meeting to eat, or even for, you know, a period of a day or 2 days, you know, okay, well, it's, I have a colonoscopy tomorrow. I'm fasting for my colonoscopy, you know, whatever. But eventually, right? Eventually, if I am not getting the calories that I need, if I go too deep into calorie deficit, which is basically what happens when we're losing weight, right? When we're losing weight, we're in calorie deficit, right? Our bodies are effectively having to go into emergency fat stores.
Yes.
Because we're running out of fuel, right? We're not getting the calories that we actually need to sustain our weight. Your body, when this is happening, is kind of going into like code red emergency zone as time goes on. And eventually that deep, deep, deep animal instinct that makes you gasp for air when you're not getting enough oxygen, right, will make you start effectively like, quote unquote, gasping for food, right? And your conscious mind will no longer matter, right? Just like with breathing, right? It is impossible to asphyxiate yourself, right? Like you cannot, you know, just hold your breath and just kill yourself that way. Like eventually that animal instinct will just pop online without your conscious permission, right? Without your permission. Very, very similar with food. I think, unfortunately, the damage that people do when they're chronically attempting to starve themselves, eventually, unfortunately, they can, you know, kill themselves, basically, which is very, very, very scary. But ultimately, your body is fighting you every single step of the way. Your body is doing everything it can to try to keep you from starving it, right? And that is effectively what binge eating is your body saying, no, 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 you want to like eat less calories than we actually need? I'm going to override you and we're going to start hoarding food. Not only am I going to make up for all the food that you haven't given me in the past week, month, year, whatever the timeline might be, I'm also going to hoard food for later because I don't trust that you're not going to try this shit again.
Yeah, so true. Right?
You know,
you failed me, bitch.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like, I do not trust that food is secure. I do not trust that there's an abundant source of food that I can access at any time. Clearly, we are in, like, you know, under the threat of famine.
Yeah. Right?
And so I am going to make sure that if I have access to food, once that animal instinct brain, that lizard brain goes on, right, and starts eating, she's going to get as much as she pot. I call her a she, right?
Oh, for real. Like my body is a she as well. So there you go.
Exactly. Exactly. She's going to get, and you could say that this is just your body, right? It's just your body versus your conscious mind, right? Your conscious mind that gives a shit about, like, you know, looking like the magazines or not even just, or just losing weight to feel, to not be stigmatized, right? I mean, it's not even about looking
fit
about it,
in.
Right? It just to feel accepted on a base core level and be treated with human dignity. I mean, right? It's not, I think it's, you know, it's well beyond vanity, right?
Yeah.
For a lot of people.
Oh, damn right. Damn right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this is what I try to tell people too. And this is actually Virgie saying, basically, because, like, I always remember her saying, well, when people say I want to lose weight, they don't actually mean I want to lose weight. They mean way more than that. They mean I want to be seen. I want to be heard. Yep. I want to be desired. I want to belong. Yep. I want to fit in, not just fit into a certain friendship group or, you know, peer group, but I want to literally fit into society, fit into airplane seats, fit into restaurant tables or, you know, these dining, diner booths and stuff like that.
Yep.
I want to literally fit into bus seats. I want to literally fit into society. And I want to be perceived as a productive and as a valuable member of society.
Yeah.
This is what they
mean.
That's
exactly right.
And
And if I have to starve myself to do it, so be it. Although people don't necessarily think always see it in that lens because you have an entire system, an entire medical system, an entire cultural system, an entire governmental system, basically telling you that this is a really great healthy thing for you to do and it's not going to kill you. It's actually, you're going to live longer. And if you don't do it, you're going to die. Right. And so
or people so you will have say, no, you're taking being... care of yourself.
Exactly.
You're doing the right thing. You're actually, quote unquote, taking care of yourself.
Right.
Like I could kill every physician who is saying that.
I know. It's really, really scary that our definition of self-care is self-starvation.
Yes. Thank you so much for that one.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really, really terrifying. Like, I mean, that's like, I want to like create a bumper sticker, like, dieting is not self-care.
I buy that.
So basically, you know, I am like, I think that, you know, it's interesting. We can get into the sort of definitions of what is binge eating versus emotional eating, right? Eating is this, it's this reaction, right? It's this reaction to being starved. It's the gasping for food. It's the feeling of, you know, like I'm going to go on a diet tomorrow. So I better get everything in now that I possibly can before the diet starts tomorrow, which is very different experience than, oh, you know, I'm feeling a little low. I think I'm going to like watch a movie and eat some ice cream. Very different experiences, right? One is much more kind of violent and aggressive because it's like literally your body fighting for its own life. It is violent and aggressive because it is desperate. It's coming from a place of actual life and death urgency from your body's point of view, right? Mm-hmm. Emotional eating, you know, which I think, again, gets confused with binge eating, I think can actually be quite pleasant. Right? Like emotional eating is quite pleasant, right? I think that's why people do it, right? It's like, oh, wow. Yeah, this is kind of nice. This is kind of sweet. I'm going to have some, you know, little ice cream, little chocolate, little whatever it is. I'm going to, you know, just get a little soothing and comfort, which food does give us by virtue of the fact that food is pleasurable and it is biologically designed for pleasure, right? So kind of coming full circle, these two things are very different, but they kind of get treated like they're the same. Or I think that there's this idea that binge eating is just emotional eating a lot because for the most part, people don't want to acknowledge in our culture that dieting is actually problematic and that dieting doesn't work, that dieting leads to binge eating, dieting leads to rebounding and rebelling, right? People don't want to acknowledge the fact that they're not as much in control of their weight as they think, that the chances of somebody, you know, going on a diet and losing weight permanent are actually very, very, very slim. And even in the cases where people are very successful at long-term permanent weight loss, they are fighting tooth and nail. It is a full-time job to accomplish that.
Very much
so. So this is, I think, you know, one of the reasons why we have such, you know, kind of misinformation about binge eating versus emotional eating, right? Is people are super confused about what these terms are. And I think largely they're confused about what these terms are because people don't want to acknowledge the reality that diets don't work. And if you're going to really get into what's really going on for people when they're binge eating, you would have to acknowledge that fact.
Oh, yeah. I also think that when people eat to numb out their emotions, would they do that if being fat was not kind of, you know, prosecuted by society? If being fat was okay, would they still feel the need to numb out their emotions, their like strong negative or positive emotions with food? Because I think that would not be the case. And
so I don't really think that food is very numbing. It's distracting. Like, I don't know. I have a hard time with this language of with the language of food being numbing in general, because I think that like alcohol is numbing. Like alcohol is a pain reliever. It is a physical numbing agent, right? Opiates, physical numbing agent. Food, the reality of the situation is like I can eat and feel my feelings at the same time. So already I'm kind of like, whenever we talk about like, you know, numbing as a food as a numbing agent, I automatically am already like a little bit on the defensive about like, really? Is that really what's going on? Or is it this whole cycle of desperately trying to lose weight and then, you know, not being able to stick to it and then feeling shame and then hating yourself, right? It's like all of that, what I call the craziness around food. Yeah, that'll certainly distract you from the rest of your life. But having ice cream isn't inherently numbing, right? Like, in my opinion. What I will say about emotional eating, because I think what you're really getting at is like, would people eat emotionally? I mean, tell me if I'm right. Are you asking, would people eat emotionally if they didn't think that fat was wrong? Is that the question?
Kind of.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you know, it's an interesting question because like the literature actually doesn't really support the concept of emotional eating outside of dieting very much. So like, this is actually in Health at Every Size, but you know, Linda Bacon, I think she reviewed like something like more than like 75 different studies that were all designed to try to figure out what makes people crack on their diets, right? Like why people can't, you know, willpower their way into diet. And what we discovered, you know, one of the things that crack on their diet is difficult emotions, right? Like, and this seems to be like, well, either for this is, you
sorry,
know,
Isabel, I'm the audio is a little bit distorted right now. I have to move my mic a little bit. Could you please answer the question again?
Yeah. So we're going to go back. I'm going to kind of redefine this question a little bit. I think, mm-hmm. you know, what I'm hearing the question is that is, would people eat emotionally if they didn't think that fat was wrong?
Yeah.
And I'm going to change that a little bit actually to say, would people eat emotionally if they weren't dieting, right? There is a definitive link, right? I don't even necessarily think it's about your stigma of weight necessarily, but certainly there is a link between dieting and restrained eating and emotional eating, right? Yeah. And this is just something that we see in the literature, right? Like, okay, so in Health at Every Size, Linda Bacon talks about reviewing like 75 different studies that showed that emotions often triggered people to quote unquote lose control and not be able to hang on to their diets anymore. But that when people who weren't dieters, right, unrestrained eaters had difficult emotions, it didn't affect their food at all. In fact, sometimes they actually lost their appetite.
Very true, yeah.
Yeah. And so this whole idea of even emotional eating, right? It's complex because even emotional eating is not really something that we see happening to people who aren't dieting, right? So there is a theory that a lot of emotional eating, and I tend to support this idea, a lot of emotional eating is basically just your willpower weakening when you're in emotional duress, yeah. right? Like if you're using willpower to try to control your food, you are going to probably have weakened willpower when you're dealing with difficult or challenging emotions, because managing difficult emotions takes energy. And we have a limited supply of energy to manage emotions and also like hang on tightly for dear God to not eat. Yeah. Right. So it takes all of your energy to hang on to your diet. So when you're hit with a major stressor, all of a sudden your like ability to hang on tightly to your diet is being compromised because you just don't have the energy to deal with both, right? Your energy is basically being compromised by this emotional stressor, right? And so you have less energy to like hang on for dear life to your diet. So basically willpower is weakened by stressors, by emotional stressors. So it is interesting. I mean, like it kind of does sort of bring into the, and this is a much more radical thing to say, but it does sort of bring into question this idea of like, does emotional eating even really exist outside of dieting? And I would say there's actually a pretty fair amount of evidence that like, it doesn't really.
Right?
Like we don't really see this, a concept of turning to food for comfort in quotes is probably more likely losing willpower, losing your resolve to not eat what you really want when you're stricken with challenging emotions, which are two very different things, right? There's a really big difference between, you know, eating food to like, you know, comfort yourself and being like, okay, I'm just like, I'm anxious right now and I just can't hold myself back anymore. And I think most of it, I mean, it's true. I mean, I always am sort of, I think it gets really complicated, the sort of definition of emotional eating, because you know, again, the food is this sort of pleasurable thing. And I think that there are all sorts of emotional reasons why somebody might eat. But for the most part, the literature is actually pretty clear that I think what most people call emotional eating is really just weakened willpower in the moment of difficult emotions.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's a radical thing to say. I mean, I still struggle talking about it because, you know, most dieters come into my work, certainly. And I was probably the same way, with a really, 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 really staunch narrative about emotional eating. Right. And it's, and you know, it is, you know, I would have said, like, of course I'm an emotional eater. Like, I'm not hungry. And, you know, I get really anxious and all of a sudden I want to eat. Right. It's like, how is that not emotional eating? Right. And it's, and it's hard to sort of be, it like really requires me to be like honest with myself about how much control I'm attempting to place around food, you know, the rest of the time throughout my day.
Yeah. And I couldn't stop, with you in that interview. I can't stop thinking about like, but what if dieting was not the norm? Like, what if there wasn't this, you know, dichotomy of, oh, this is what a good body looks like, this is what a bad body looks like. Like, what if that whole thing didn't exist? Like, what if there was nuance to begin with? And what if, body types were just, you know, body types. Would people then be inclined to quote unquote eat their feelings as much as they do? I would suggest
that
we
wouldn't even have the concept of emotional eating, right? So for the most part, we have, and this is not theory, like we have evidence of this, right? So like pre-diet culture, like all of history pre-diet culture is, there's quite a bit of recordings, right? We hear about alcoholism. We know that alcoholism has existed for hundreds and hundreds of years. This quote unquote food addiction thing, this quote unquote emotional eating thing, quote unquote binge eating, none of that existed until diet culture came along for the most part, right? We don't see or hear about it anywhere historically referenced until there becomes this reason why I'm supposed to control my food. And now we need a narrative to explain why I can't.
Exactly.
Right? And emotional eating becomes the narrative for why I can't, right? When in reality, probably what's more likely happening is that your biology is the reason why you can't, right? And your willpower, again, may still, it's real that willpower, you know, the moments of will and when your willpower cracks are more likely to happen when you're having difficult emotions for all of the reasons that we just described. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that this cracking probably wouldn't have happened eventually anyway. Right?
Very true. Yeah.
The way I think about it is like emotions will bring the binge, so to speak, or the rebound or the correction. It's really a correction, right? It's like it's an energy deficit correction, right? Emotions will bring the energy deficit correction to the surface faster. Right? They will get you, they will bring the correction on more quickly because your willpower will be weaker, right? It's like, if I'm trying to hold my breath, right? Or if I'm trying to control my breathing and somebody walks into the room and startles me, maybe I would have been able to hold it a little longer if somebody hadn't come in and startled me. But somebody came in and startled me. And so it just happened a little bit faster than I thought. Yeah. Emotions are kind of like that, right? Like emotions will come in, you'll have an anxious moment, you'll have a stressor, something will happen that will disrupt your focus and diligence on hanging on to your diet, right? And I think I would say a huge amount of emotional eating falls into that category. Now, it's challenging because as somebody who's been not dieting now for over a decade, right? And for the most part, I would say, it's funny, I don't even make a distinction in my mind anymore about like eating for hunger versus eating emotionally. I don't even make the distinction anymore because at this point I just eat what I want, right? And I don't have this really like clear, like, oh, am I hungry? Like, should I be eating? Like, I just eat when I want. And I would say a good portion of that time, if I probably checked in, it would probably be like, yeah, I'm like a little hungry, or like, yeah, there's something going on. But sometimes, you know, it'll just be like, I had dinner an hour ago, but I still want more, an hour later. And I don't even know if that's emotional or if that's just appetite. So this is another thing that gets really complicated about intuitive eating in general. And one of the challenges that I think that we don't talk about enough in intuitive eating circles is this concept of appetite or mental hunger. So
let's go there, please. That is also one of my favorite topics to talk about, actually.
which also gets confused for emotional eating, right? Yeah. I think we think of emotional eating as like extra calories that we don't need, in quotes, don't need. But the reality of the situation is like, and I think this is a really big problem with intuitive eating, actually. Like, I think that this is something that we need to be talking about in intuitive eating more, is that your hunger is not just happening in your belly. It's also happening in your brain, right? Appetite.
Of course.
Right? Like,
and appetite, everywhere in your body, like, oh, yes, your cells are hungry. God damn it.
Right. So if that's the case, how do you even know? How can you even make a distinction between quote unquote extra emotional eating and mental hunger or appetite? You can't.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you really can't, right? I mean, the only way maybe to make a distinction is if you're like, I know that I'm really anxious or sad right now and I want to eat. What I will say is, since when people stop dieting, they do start to have these experiences over time that quote unquote normal eaters have, whereas like when emotions are really strong, you'll notice that you're not as interested in food a lot of the time.
Yeah. This happened to me a few years back now, more and more actually. And I listened to some podcast episodes and podcast interviews with you before. And you keep saying that, you know, in How That Every Size, Linda Bacon, just casually on a, I still have to find that, that part again. I read the book, but I really have to underline it and like really copy it or something like that. Just casually references that. Yeah. What was it? Out of,
restrained eaters tend to turn towards food under emotional duress.
Yeah. And this is
unrestrained eaters turn away.
Exactly. That is it. And Lindo even says, it's just like a follow up sentence.
It's so less than a paragraph. Yeah.
Yeah. It's less than a paragraph. Exactly that. And just like, oh yeah. So we found out that, what was it? So experience shows. Yeah. Something like that. Experience shows that restrained eaters tend to eat more when they're under emotional duress than people who have never restrained before. And that's just like, that is absolutely mind blown. I'm making the mind blown sign. People can't see that obviously right now, but like that really was just like, fuck yeah. That explains the difference between me and my boyfriend and me and, you know, people who have never, ever been on a diet, like mostly men. Because when my boyfriend is, you know, facing like a job interview or something that is like inherently stressful, right?
Yeah.
He cannot eat for the life of himself. He cannot swallow anything. Like it's like this whole like his esophagus is basically closed or something like that. And to me, it used to be the opposite. I was turning to food like predominantly and very, very violent.
But really, really what was probably more likely happening was, again, your willpower weakens when you're under emotional duress and you just were like losing it, right? And then so you basically triggers this reactionary eating, which is, right? I mean, it's interesting, this concept of like, does like pure quote unquote emotional eating exist? And again, it's a really complicated question. I think that this is like a major, I'm writing the like working with emotional eating module for my professional training program right now. And this is something that we really, really dig into, is like, what is the validity of the concept of the narrative of emotional eating, right? Like how much should we even be talking about this with our clients, right? Like, where is this really, is there relevance in like working with people around emotional eating? To what extent is, you know, at what point is emotional eating probably, you know, just binge eating that's just being, you know, effectively triggered, right? Like losing control on your diet because your willpower has been weakened by emotions. To what extent is emotional eating quote unquote real? Meaning like you could be completely not controlling at all and actually want, you know, just a cupcake for comfort and, it's a really challenging question, because I also think, you know, and this is sort of just an Isabel Fox and Duke theory, there's no science behind this, but I wonder about it, because there are certainly moments where I do find myself still 10 years after not dieting being like, oh, I'm just gonna like, I'm bored, I'm whatever, I'm gonna go have like a little something. And it's still unclear to me on like a personal experience level. I'm like, wait, but is that real emotional eating? Even though like the literature doesn't really support this. And again, it happens much less frequently, significantly less frequently than it did when I was dieting. When I was dieting, every emotion would send me into breaking my diet, basically.
Yes.
But there's this question about like, is emotional eating real? Like, what is the relationship? And I think that there's, it's super complicated, right? Because again, food is pleasurable, right? There is this pleasure component. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that that's a good thing. Like, I love emotional, like, I love, you know, sometimes when I just like need to like blow off some steam at the end of the day, I love having like really delicious food and watching TV, you know, like
that. I mean, that is so good, honestly. And I haven't told you that about me. I am half French, actually. So
you are.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
I am. So right. my people, we invented emotional eating, Isabel.
Yeah.
We talk about food all day, every day, 24/7. La bouffe, la bouffe, la bouffe. It's all we talk about. We talk about preparing a dish while we're eating another one.
Exactly. This is the thing. So it gets complicated. It's like, on the one hand, like, this idea of like turning to food when under emotional duress is something that we, you know, pretty much exclusively see in dieters. But at the same time, there's something about emotional eating, and not in like a bad way or a wrong way. Again, I love emotional eating. I think emotional eating is wonderful. Yeah. but there's something there that feels like it has some weight outside of dieting. And again, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a wonderful thing. It's like, food is a pleasure. There's a cultural warmth to it. There's memories associated with food. So, you know, I think that it's a really rich discussion with a lot to talk about there. I also think it's possible, and this is what I was going to say, is like the purely non-science based, just Isabel Fox and Duke theory. Sometimes I wonder, like, do I find food more comforting than somebody who's never dieted before in their life because I have trauma around food insecurity,
maybe.
Right? And so, like, you know, like for me, like as a person who's had foods, you know, banned and taken away from them, like it makes sense to me that like I would find foods more comforting still, even 10 years after dieting. But again, there's no science around that. That's just like, you know, totally just like a curiosity.
I'm with you on that. I'm 100% with you on that, because I feel the same. And I mean, we both can agree, I guess, that like emotional eating, pure, like eating for the pure joy of it without ever having dieted, like, is totally a thing. Look at French people, look at Italian people, look at Chinese people, like look at Indian people, for all like look at people all around the globe, and you know, eating cultures and cuisines and all this beautiful, you know, making the best of out of the ingredients that you have, and cooking and enjoying and everything. And also, like you said, eating is culture. Like eating is part of culture, and eating even reinforces culture. As a cultural anthropologist, I can tell you this. Eating is also ancestry, you know, passing down of recipes, passing down of a certain way of netting the dough for a certain recipe, passing on how you decorate something, it's tradition, it's ancestry, it's memories. I mean, we all, every single one of us has one childhood dish that, like, I hope that every one of us has that experience that a caring member of our family prepared for us. Like every single one of us has one of those dishes. So
yeah, there's something caring. Caring is a good word, right? There's a sense of caring that sometimes we can get from food, right? That's really... nice and wonderful. And I hate that the diet industry has villainized it so much.
And taken it away from us even.
And taken it. Yes. Yes. And I wonder, it's like, so, I mean, and I think the other sort of mythology around though, what, something that I also bring up with clients a lot is like this kind of eating, this sort of like, you know, pleasure, emotional eating probably isn't going to, there's no evidence that you can like learn how to stop doing that and lose weight permanently, right? Like, I think the other reason why people get hung up on emotional eating is they're like, oh, well, diets don't work. But if I stopped emotionally eating, then I would lose weight. And yeah. I think that's another sort of myth that people have that like, oh, I get that I can't diet, but like, especially in like sort of quote unquote intuitive eating weight loss land.
Yes. Right? Please talk about it.
Yeah. So intuitive eating weight loss land is something you're very familiar with, oh, which yeah. is when people try to attempt the non-diet approach, but they think that there's like, oh, there's some sort of way to control your weight within the non-diet approach, right? Like, so for instance, if I'm eating within the context of hunger and fullness correctly, if I'm not eating outside of the context of hunger and fullness, which again is really difficult to define because hunger is not a very specific, it's not one specific physical tangible sensation. Hunger happens in a billion different ways, including just thoughts about food could be a result of hunger, right? So
I recently learned within my training as a certified intuitive eating counselor that hunger, like neurobiologically, is even starting when you feel a tangible drop in concentration.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like there's your hunger is something that happens just as much in our minds as it does in our bellies, right? And I think that that is really it kind of puts a wrench in the whole emotional eating narrative, or it puts a wrench in the whole concept of like, well, if I just didn't eat emotionally, or if I just didn't eat quote unquote outside of hunger, it's like, yeah. Well, how do you know? What does that mean? Outside of hunger? Like, how are we even defining hunger right now? Because there's a billion different ways. Just having a thought about food could mean you're hungry, right?
Yes.
So it's like, even when I have dinner, and I noticed, because I think I may have given this example already, like I could have dinner and then an hour later be like, you know what? I just like want a little something else. Like, yeah. I just like need a little something else. That could be my body being like, we're not quite satisfied. Mm-hmm. We just need a little something else. And that doesn't necessarily mean that it is quote unquote emotional and not physical. That's the other thing I think that's complicated about emotional eating is we talk about emotional eating like it's separate from hunger, like it's separate from our bodies. When the truth is like, it's all mixed up. It's like our emotions, our hunger, it's all like one jumble.
Yeah.
You cannot separate emotional eating from hunger eating. You can't. Like, it's impossible. Like,
true, like, true. And why would you? I mean, if you were truly to separate all the emotions from eating that you are having, you would right. be eating Soylent, and that would be the only thing that you would be eating for the rest of your life. And yeah, I, for one, I actually like to chew my food. I don't know about you, Isabel, but I actually like to chew my food.
Exactly. Exactly. So, you know, it's an interesting, complex conversation, I think, even within the world of intuitive eating, because, you know, the sort of general idea of intuitive eating, I mean, like I was talking to a friend the other day and she said, and she's, you know, not a friend like in this industry or anything like that. I mean, I barely have even spoken to her about what I do for a living. I don't even think, you know, she really knows what I do. But I mentioned intuitive eating to her casually in the context of, you know, some other story. And she said, oh, well, you know, the other day I had 2 bags of chips. I was definitely not eating intuitively. And there's this idea that intuitive eating is the specific way, right? That there's this specific way of eating that is intuitive, that is correct intuitive eating.
Oh, I hate
and that's
that.
Just not, yeah. And that's just not accurate. I mean, that's why I'm kind of like, you know, just, yeah. So anyway, this all to say, it's a good and interesting question. Would people quote unquote eat emotionally if they weren't dieting? And I think the answer is it depends on how you're defining the term emotional eating. Yeah. But by and large, a lot of what we call, there's a good evidence to suggest that a lot of what we call emotional eating is more likely just loss of willpower at the hands of difficult emotions.
I agree. I agree completely. I agree completely. And I think that it's a very important discussion to have even in emotional eating circles. In intuitive eating circles. Emotional and intuitive eating circles, of course.
Especially in an intuitive eating circles, you know? I mean, intuitive eating has a long history of, you know, not talking about this. So we need to make sure we're talking about it in intuitive eating circles.
Oh, so true. Spot on. And I will copy the term, and of course credit you, intuitive eating weight loss land, because then it's so spot on. I just wrote that down, actually. It's just so good. Because that's what my home country is, basically. That's what Germany has become. We talked
a lot about it. A lot of America still is that.
Even after 25 years of intuitive eating, come on.
Well, first of all, intuitive eating hasn't been that body positive for 25 years. That's a relatively new development. I mean, intuitive eating only, you know, got, I mean, it took even a few years after the book came out, even after the Health at Every Size book came out, for the classic intuitive eating book as we know it to be edited to really, you know, kind of incorporate some of these ideas, right? Intuitive eating, and also I will say intuitive eating has a long history before the book, right? So Evelyn Tribolian and Elise Reich, they wrote this book called Intuitive Eating, but the movement of intuitive eating, the existence, the concept of letting go of diets in quotes and listening to your body signals is something that had a long history well into, you know, the 70s, going back to Susie Orbach's Fat as a Feminist Issue, right? So the intuitive eating movement well predates the book, first of all.
I own it, and I'm holding it into the camera. I read it, too.
Yeah.
And
I mean,
also,
it's a problematic book. It's very outdated. But so this is what I'm saying. Intuitive eating has a long history of not being very body positive. Intuitive eating actually has its roots in weight loss industry. Early days of intuitive eating was a diet world, right? The way that we would now disguise diet. They would not call themselves diets at that time. They would say we're the anti-diet, but it was still a weight loss methodology for many, many years and for many, many contributors to this movement. People like Janine Roth. I mean, I first discovered intuitive eating through Janine Roth. That was my first introduction to intuitive eating. And at the time, I was like, felt like I was having a revelation. And I was having a revelation. I have to kind of credit Janine Roth to some extent.
I credit her too.
You know, like I have such a complicated relationship with her. I mean, not personally, I don't know her personally, but within myself, I have a complicated relationship with her because, like, on the one hand, she was really the person who showed me that, you know, traditional diets, the way we typically think of them, don't work and are the root cause of things like binge eating. But at the same time, she's clearly an advocate for the don't eat emotionally diet.
Yeah.
And she clearly, you know, and she clearly thinks that, like, there is a right way to eat intuitively so that you can lose weight, right? And she still to this day has not changed her tune, which I think is really my disappointment with Janine Roth, is that she hasn't evolved. Whereas, like, Elise and Evelyn have evolved. Like, Elise and Evelyn are, like, staying hip with the moment, right? Like, they have actually edited the book multiple times to adapt to the changing realities of the fat positive, body positive movement. You know, again, still like issues, I think, you know, as there probably always will be with intuitive eating. I don't see intuitive eating as being a place where we're ever completely free from all of this stuff just because of the nature of the content itself. But yeah, I think that that's, you know, this, it's important to always remember when we're talking about intuitive eating, that intuitive eating comes from a history of diet culture. It does not come from a history of, sadly, right. And so, you know, this is something to just sort of like be aware of, right? Is most of the challenges that people will face, most of the challenges that your clients will face when they're attempting intuitive eating are approaching intuitive eating like it as a diet or attempting some kind of body or weight control or food control through the tenets or principles of intuitive eating.
Or emotion control and like, oh, at least I can control my emotions and then I cannot eat as much and then I can lose weight and then everything will be wonderful and unicorns and rainbows will pop out of the sky and I will shit gold or whatever.
Which is also just not evidenced by science. Like there is no, just like, you know, there's no evidence that you can effectively teach your, learn, you can, there's no like controlling your emotions diet, right? Like there's no evidence that like you can effectively learn how to better handle emotions and that that how somehow will lead to better weight loss.
Yes. Yes.
Like exactly. There's no evidence of that. Like the don't eat emotionally, there's no evidence to support the don't eat emotionally diet actually leading to long-term weight loss.
Yes. Yes.
Like,
yes.
It doesn't.
I know. I know. Thank for you to say that. Like I keep saying that in my sessions, but I just realized I need to put that more out there. Like there is no sustained like
method scientific weight control that exists. Yeah.
Scientific evidence that if you learn to control your emotions or manage your emotions, either be it like with mindfulness or mindfulness-based stress relief or anything like that, that you will lose weight by meditating. I mean,
yeah, there's no evidence that you can learn that you can lose weight through the process of better managing emotions. No. You might be happier. You might have a better life. You might diet less, actually, right? Like there is evidence to suggest that things like mindfulness and learning how to manage emotions and learning how to withstand and tolerate a broader range of feelings in the body, those things actually help us do something called giving up dieting. Yeah. Which is possible, right? Which is, that's really, I mean, I am all about mindfulness and you know, learning to be with feelings, but not in the service of controlling food, which is a completely waste of your time, right? Yes. Like there's no evidence that that's going to help you. In fact, it'll probably just harm you to be applying attempts at mindfulness for the purpose of weight loss.
Yeah.
But what we do know mindfulness is good for is for helping people let go of dieting and for helping people feel more comfortable in their bodies and being able to manage the anxiety that comes up as a result of living in a traumatic fat phobic culture.
Yeah. So true.
You and know, also, like that's really where it's at. Like I think of like mindfulness and, you know, sort of, you know, all kinds of emotional work in general. I think of like the real value of that and being helping people let go of dieting and managing the difficult feelings that come up around having a body in a culture that hates bodies.
Yeah. Yeah. So true. So true. There's a truth nugget right there. And this is exactly what I found out through your work, through, you, of course, were my first stop on this beautiful rally that has been going on and it is still going on because Kunzo Yue Shui Buzi Yun, which Confucius says that learning knows no bounds. You keep learning, you keep evolving, every one of us. I studied Chinese studies too, by the way. So,
yay!
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, and that is the only Confucius saying that I picked up and that I can still quote to this day. And
love it.
Thank you. Yeah, and that really is that. Okay, I have one question for you that I want to ask all my podcast guests. And it might be a little unusual one.
Okay.
Because I want to give you a chance to, yeah. So let me just ask it. So yeah. What is a topic or maybe a question that you are not asked enough? Like no one asked you this actually, but you are thrilled to answer.
Oof. I know this is like a hard one. I mean, probably, honestly, like how do we change the culture?
Good one.
You know, like I think we talk a lot about the culture is a problem and how do we protect ourselves individually in the culture and how do we not diet even though we're in the culture and blah, blah, blah. But I think that something that I rarely get asked, probably because I'm usually being interviewed by coaches who are, you know, creating content for the purpose of like helping individuals. Right. But one of the things I rarely get asked is like, okay, like what can we do to actually change the culture? And something that I think about a lot is like, you know, how do we take this from a movement about a bunch of individuals managing the culture and actually start making like really, really broad range cultural change. And obviously part of that is going to be, you know, culture is a series, is a bunch of individuals, right? So,
yeah.
You know, there's something very, very important about individual change, and it does start with you. But something that I never get talked about, I feel like never gets talked about in the body positive movement, for all of this discussion about fat liberation, body positivity, it's like, why isn't anyone talking about the fact that it is currently legal to discriminate against people in the United States in pretty much every single municipal in the United States? There are no civil rights. It is completely legal to discriminate against people on the basis of size, for instance, in employment settings. Why aren't we talking about that? I mean, we really are not talking about that very much in the body positive movement as a whole. Generally speaking, most people in the body positive movement might not even be aware of that.
Yeah.
Right? They're not even thinking about that. Right. So like, I'm kind of interested in like what changes need to happen at like the judicial, civil, legislative levels, right, in order for us to live in a different world. And I think a lot of that has to do with like people need to start bringing like lawsuits to the table. Like, I feel like if I could go back to school and if somebody was like, okay, go back to school, you can't be a coach, but you have to do something else for body positivity in the land of like, you know, moving forward fat rights or size inclusive rights, I would go get my law degree and I would start finding people who are being discriminated against, because I know they're all over the place. And I would just start like literally causing legal havoc all over the place, which I'm not aware of happening very much, even though in my opinion, that's when we're really going to start seeing some changes. Like, you know, we can talk about fat discrimination all day long, but like, what are we actually doing as a culture to like create legal and judicial protections for fat people, right? So that's, I mean, that's something that I feel passionately about, and I feel like we're not talking about enough in the movement in general.
Totally agree. And I talked with Evelyn Triboli, mainly Evelyn, Elise a little bit, but Evelyn in supervision about it. It's actually bad that I bring this up right now because it's my personal supervision and I share some of it with the whole world and with you and as of this moment. So I'm actually a bad supervisee, so to speak. But Evelyn told me that she completely understands that fat activists don't care so much for intuitive eating because they have bigger fish to fry. Like they have bigger things to do.
Yeah.
And it's like they have bigger problems to advocate for. So what if you eat a delicious cupcake when you are bored or tired or whatever? The thing is that people are still, you know, discriminated so like being denied access to medical care, being denied access to jobs, and therefore to money, to wealth, to status, to prestige, to like everything, just based off how they look. Like
it's awful.
Fat people are paid, I think I read a German statistic. Fat people in general on an average base are paid up to 30% less than their thin peers for the very same job.
Fat women are discriminated against in courts of law. So like if you have a trial in the United States, you are going to be looked at with similar levels of discrimination as you would if you were a Black woman. Which for Americans means something, right? Because generally speaking, not all Americans, unfortunately, but a good portion of us understand that that's a big deal, right? So, you know, I think people are very surprised by that statistic. So it's happening all over the place. It's happening, you know, it's product design, right? Like you mentioned, you know, how we're accommodated physically or how fat people are accommodated physically in the world.
Yeah.
It's medical. It's jobs, which is finances, which is power. It's, I mean, it just like the list goes on. Criminal justice, the list just goes on and on, right? So this is serious, you know? I mean, quite frankly, intuitive eating is the lesser. I mean, it's the least of your average fat person's problems, right?
Yeah,
it's true. Totally.
It's very much true. Yeah. And I have, as much as I bitch about my home country and that I do have good reason to do so because of, you know, intuitive eating being being translated into intuitive weight loss and causing a lot of people to jump on that bandwagon and ride that horse to death. And the one at the spear front of it is even a medical doctor, which makes it so much worse. That happening. On the other hand, the German or German speaking, like, you know, in Germany, Switzerland and Austria, fat activism is actual and fat studies that is like forming or has been forming for several years. That is very, very active. And I can tell you that for the state that I like, the German state that I live in, city state, Berlin, there is a very, very nice development that the political party has considered taking weight discrimination into the official catalog of things, of discrimination things, you know, things that can be policed when discriminated against.
Awesome.
Like sexual orientation, religion.
Awesome.
Color of skin, stuff like that. Unfortunately, they voted on it, and unfortunately, it didn't go through the first time, but it was on the agenda. And when it is on the agenda, it will be brought back again, again, and again. And there is one German association, it's called Deutsche Gesellschaft gegen Gewichtsdiskriminierung, so the German Association Against the Discrimination against Weight or Based on Weight. German Association Against the Discrimination Based on Weight. There you go. And they're doing so, like, they're the only lobby organ from, like, by fat people for fat people in Germany. And they're doing phenomenal work. And to each and every one of my fat clients, I just recommend to follow them or to even become a member. Yeah, so unfortunately, it didn't go through. We were putting our hopes onto it, but it has been tried and it will be tried time and time again. So there are attempts on it in Germany.
And there actually are attempts also in certain cities and states in the U.S. So that is happening slowly but surely. But the vast majority of the United States is obviously not protected. So we've got our work cut out for us.
Oh, we certainly do. We certainly do. And it's like I always say, feeling good in your own skin is just the beginning. Because if you start to feel good inside your own skin, no matter the size, right? And if you are able to recognize that people come in all shapes and sizes, and if you are able to, you know, see past vanity appearance and all that, you realize that all people have the same rights and are deserving of the same rights. And then you start advocating for yourself and or for others. And this, like, it has to be political at some point because caring for yourself is inherently political if you have a deviant, like a quote unquote deviant body or a body that is being, has been made deviant by society.
Anyone on the margins. You've got to be protecting and including. Well, thank you for asking that question because I think that is, again, I don't mean to say there aren't people, there are certainly people talking about this, but I think it's not a question that I get asked a ton. And so I get excited to talk about it because that's, I think, where some of my sort of deepest passions in this issue really lie, is not necessarily with food, but about sort of broader ranging fat rights.
Yeah. Social justice in the best possible term.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, so, and I'm grateful that you answered this. I'm grateful that I could spark some passion in you with just a simple question as that, because like I feel that people can always, you know, people can always research you. People can always, you know, look you up. They can always read through your blog, but it's talking about the stuff that we rarely get asked that, but we are passionate about that really, you know, show the world who we truly are and what we truly care for.
Yeah, totally. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh no, you got it. I am also very excited and passionate. good segue to talk about what's next for you, because you have so much big things going on right now. And you are... You are evolving and you are growing your business. I mean, you have been growing as a person, obviously, in the last past years. Otherwise, you wouldn't grow your business. And I've been with you since 2012, since my mom passed away, and you helped me so gratefully out of that. So,
I've got a lot of interesting things. Well, so as you know, I don't know if you ever took the masterclass.
No, I never did, unfortunately.
I know. You should just take it. It's now actually at a super reasonable price. I feel like there's so much. I mean, there's just so much content in the masterclass. It's crazy. And it's like really kind of like the magnum opus, like body of my work in terms of coaching. But so the masterclass, I think, is where, you know, anyone who's listening to this, if there's any kind of still struggle with food, or even, you know, just kind of a curiosity more about my unique perspective on these issues, the masterclass is, you know, is the flagship program, certainly still for my business. And that you can learn about at stopfightingfood.com. But also, I'm going to be doing more professional training as time goes on. So about 3 years ago, I mentioned that I sort of started transitioning into doing most of my private work with coaches and wellness professionals who want to be teaching and working with people around these issues. And so that is transitioning into, there's sort of like a new kind of more formalized curriculum-based training program that I'm going to be launching on October 8th for professionals who want to learn how to work with people around food and body issues, right, in a very definitively and distinctly weight-neutral way. And also get some business and marketing training around how to grow a business, how to actually, you know, develop a body positive coaching business. Because I think that that's something that, I mean, we talked about this a little bit earlier. I think people are really focused on getting the training and then they don't know what to do with it, right? They can't reach the people that they want to reach, right? And so that's, true, I think, an important an important second half of the process. Is actually being able to, you know, grow and develop, you know, a list of clientele, a number of people that you can work with. And, you know, depending on the level that you want to grow, I'm really interested in doing business and marketing training with people who want to grow kind of like a larger audiences online and really get this message out to the largest numbers of people possible. So yeah, that's what I'm working on. And that, that's going to be launching on October 8th. So pretty soon this podcast may be coming out even past that date. And yeah, and it'll be really interesting to see how that program develops, is that's really where most of my energy has been focused in the past couple of years. And it seems to be kind of ramping up more and more in that direction. I think that that's where there's a lot of opportunity for me to serve right now.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I just started my business. Like I've started my business 3 months ago as of this date that we're recording. So I consider myself a total newbie. I have been fat activist or armchair fat activist before, since 2014, 2015, like really getting the message. And 2016, I was the only European in Virgie Tovar's Babe Camp Jamaica. Back then. And I never planned to do that work, to be honest with you. Like I never ever planned to become a coach myself. I never ever planned to do this professionally. I never ever planned to quit my day job. It happened because Corona hit and because I got asthma. And if you are literally 3 centimeters away from another person's face, plucking their eyebrows, you and they cough, you think twice about still coming to work. And I started doing the certification for intuitive eating counselor in May this year, 2020. And I did that while I was still working, and I was planning on doing it on the side. So that was the thing. But then I was just like, nope, my lungs are just more valuable to me, and I'm gonna dive in fully. And I can attest to what you said before about marketing, because how do you market peace with food? Like, how do you do that? Because people are so used to hearing the diet message and the quick fix, and people want the quick fix. They want to like slim down in order to fit their, I mean, like I always have that image in my mind of the woman like trying desperately to shrink herself down to two dress sizes in order to fit into the maid of honor dress for her cousin's wedding. And she has 3 months to do so. So she's going to starve herself like really badly in order to fit that one dress for that one occasion. And then, you know, go back to diet binge and the diet binge cycle and whatnot. And it's easy to kind of market for something that, you know, oh, and you can reach your goal very quickly and, you know, very effectively, and you can fit into that dress that you wanted to fit in and stuff like that. Whereas marketing to a more long-term goal of actually feeling good inside your own skin, regardless of your weight, and actually, you know, having peace with food, peace with your body, and meaningful connections in life, and also, you know, learning how to develop resiliency around medical personnel so that you can tell them, look, no, I cannot lose the amount of weight that you suggest for me to lose within our next appointment in 2 months in a healthy way. And you know that too. In the meantime, are there any patients of yours that have the very same symptoms that I'm suffering from that are thin? And if so, how do you treat them? I want the same treatment. And like, how do you market all this? How do you sell all this convincingly in order to appeal to not just the people who already, you know, are on the fence about stopping to diet, but also about the people who are still kind of caught up with diet culture and just, you know, they heard about anti-diet somewhere, but they don't really know what it is. Like, how do you market peace with food?
Oh, wow. You'll have to take the course to find out. This is a major topic of discussion in the program for sure. So, yeah.
All right. I don't want to take away too much.
Heavily covered. Yes, absolutely. That is the question, or one of the questions. It's one of the questions. So, yeah. Yes, absolutely. That will be heavily discussed.
Yeah, and I can tell you from the other side now, which is still strange for me to say because it's still so new to me, that this is very much the million-dollar question, isn't it? Like, how do you market peace with food, and how do you sell peace with food? How much time do we got left?
We'll have to save it for another interview.
I think so too. But I just quickly mentioned that I listened to Kyla Tova's podcast, Your Body, Your Brand. And that thing was like eye-opening to me because there was one coach who was selling their trauma consistently and advertising their trauma consistently. And had to stop because, like, retelling the narrative of, look, I used to be miserable, I used to be bad, and now I overcame it, that took a toll on her. And so marketing in a world that is used to diet marketing and being anti-mainstream, that is actually the biggest question. And I'm... Yeah, I'm thrilled to know that you're going to address that and that you're going to talk about it in depth to professionals.
yes, absolutely. Cool.
That is so great. That is so great.
Yeah.
Isabel, I'm so excited for like you stepping up to the next level, stepping into your larger living, if you will. Like, this is kind of thing that is going on for me as well. And it's also going on for you as well. And become the teacher for the teacher.
Yeah.
In a way. And would you please just tell people how they can find you, what they can find you, what they can find from you online, I'm sorry, and how to reach out to you.
Well, at the moment, the place to find me is, stopfightingfood.com is a great place if you want to just kind of get like a good introduction to my sort of philosophy, core ideas, which I already mentioned. And then also just isabelfoxanddupe.com at the moment is the best place to find me. There's the first few blog posts on isabelfoxanddupe.com also really go in depth on my philosophy and my point of view. And it's a great place to sign up for emails and just stay connected. So I don't use social media a ton. I'm not very consistent on social media personally. But if you check out the blog and the website, emails are really where it's at. And I know you already mentioned my emails. I absolutely love staying connected with people via email. And I try to make my emails short and sweet and easy to digest. So
yeah, I can attest to that.
Yeah,
they're not the clunky emails that people are used to. They are actually good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's really where it's at for me is not so much social media, much more emails, right? Sign up for emails and get like little, you know, just kind of really short, little, easy, digestible, body positive nuggets in your inbox, you know, once or twice a week. It's worth it.
Oh yeah, I can totally attest to it. Thank you so much, Isabel. This has been like really amazing. I'm glad that we got to dive really deep into different topics and that are not discussed enough. I will stop recording right now. And I thank you so much.
It's no secret, it's a fact. I'm technically obese, I'm wobbly, jiggly, and round. In a word, quite frankly, I'm fat. The word fat can sometimes cause a bit of shock. Some people are offended, but I'm not. I've owned it and reclaimed it, and I'm not afraid to say it. I'm fat, and frankly, I rock. I won't apologize for taking up space in the world. I'm living large and I'm not gonna stop. My body sings and dances and it's a tiger in the bedroom. And that's just some of why my fat body rocks. The war on obesity's a pile of shit. They just want to sell you one more diet book. They spend $650 billion around the world. So we're at war against the way that people look.